Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. Today is the 22nd of July 2015 and I'm delighted once again to welcome to the programme Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, very well known to listeners of The Mind Renewed and one of the most highly sought after commentators on geopolitics and economics in the alternative media. Dr. Roberts' career has spanned academia, journalism, business and public service. He's held numerous senior academic positions in universities. He was an associate editor and columnist for the Wall Street Journal. He served as assistant secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy during Reagan's first term in office, after which he was a consultant to the US Department of Defense and the US Department of Commerce. Dr. Roberts, it really is great to be speaking with you again. Thanks very much for joining us.
I'm pleased to be with you, Julian.
Well, as I said to you, every time you've come on, people do very much appreciate your insights into what's going on in the world. And it's very clear from the feedback that I receive after each interview with you. So it's great to be able to pick your brains yet again. So this time, I want to ask you for your take on the so-called Greek debt crisis. I'm calling it so-called, and I think that will become obvious as we discuss, and the somewhat bewildering events, really, that have taken place over the past couple of weeks with this initial rejection by the Greek people of further austerity, swiftly followed by an embracing of that austerity by the Greek government, and perhaps what this might signify beyond Greece itself for the rest of Europe. So can we start at the beginning with basically this question? Can you explain for us how Greece got into this dreadful situation in the first place?
Yes. You know, many of the Greek governments have been known for their corruption. And it appears that much of the existing Greek sovereign debt was created by foreign banks coming to governments and saying, hey, for example, this is an example. A German bank comes and says, hey, wouldn't you like to borrow a few billion euros and then you can buy some German submarines from Germany? And by the way, here's a bag full of money for going along with the deal. So a great deal of the loans never came into the Greek economy. The Greek government was there collecting a fee for indebting Greece so that, for example, German manufacturers could get orders. So that's the origin of a lot of this. That's one way they got in trouble. Another way they got in trouble was by joining the EU, by joining the euro, because any government that is a member of the eurozone, you see, the British are in the EU, but they are not in the euro. They kept their own currency. They have their own central bank. Mm-hmm. So the British government can finance itself, but not the governments that are dependent on the euro, because they can't print euros. They essentially don't have a central bank, and so they cannot finance themselves. So a country that can't finance itself is not really sovereign. Hmm. So these are the two ways they got into the trouble, and of course they were helped into the euro by Goldman Sachs, which came in and devised a scheme for the Greek government to hide the debt. They created, I think, some kind of derivatives that sort of hid the debt so that they met the requirements for joining into the euro. So Goldman Sachs played a hand in this as well. So that's how it came about.
Do you know if the action by Goldman Sachs was illegal or if it was just sort of morally unacceptable?
You know, that would be up to a prosecutor. Hmm. He can make it either way. But since the prosecutors don't dare take on Goldman Sachs, it will never be an issue.
Right, okay, yeah.
So, you know, if a prosecutor wanted to go after them on criminal grounds, he could do it, but he doesn't want to.
Right.
So I think what's important, Julian, to understand is that what you call the so-called debt crisis, It's not a debt crisis. It's not about debt. First of all, it would be very easy to solve if the EU regarded it as a debt crisis. It would be solved the same way the Federal Reserve solved the problem of the mortgage-backed securities held by the big New York banks. It simply printed the money and bought the securities from the banks. So the securities move from the banks, where they were a problem for the solvency of the banks, to the Federal Reserve's balance sheet, where they're not a problem for anything. They just disappear.
So that would be the European Central Bank actually buying that debt.
The European Central Bank could buy, they wouldn't need to buy all of the Greek debt, just the amount that would comprise a haircut so that the remaining amount could be serviced by the country. See, the problem is the size of the Greek debt. It's too big for the economy to bear. And therefore, the central bank would only need to buy that percentage that brought the debt down to a level that the country could service. They don't do this because the debt crisis is being used by the EU and by the 1% to establish two new principles. One principle is creditor banks are no longer responsible if they make bad loans. So if a bank overlends to an entity that can't pay, particularly if that entity is a sovereign state, then the bank is not responsible, but the citizens of that country are responsible. And they can be forced to pay by forcing down their pensions, forcing down their salaries, forcing down employment, cutting back their social services, and forcing the country to sell off national assets.
So you say, so you say this is established as a principle then. Is this is what you as an economist would call moral hazard, presumably, but this would be on a massive scale.
Well, see, the way you traditionally deal with over-indebtedness is part of it is written down. But what they're saying now is, no, that's an old rule. The new rule is the people in the country, they are forced into lower living standards, thus freeing resources to pay the creditors.
So if this is established as a principle, then presumably this gives greater freedom to creditors in future to think to themselves, well, look, we can make any ridiculous loan and behave totally irresponsibly because we know that we're going to be bailed out in some way in the end by the people of that country.
Yes, and it's not so much that they're bailed out. They will intentionally get countries over indebted so that they can loot the countries. See, the solution that the EU is imposing on Greece allows the 1% to loot Greece. Greece has to sell water companies to outside private interests, most likely customers of the banks, of the creditor banks. They have to sell their ports. They've got to sell protected national islands. So these assets are then borrowed up on the cheap. But then what happens to the Greeks' water bill?
I presume that goes up.
It goes up. Yeah. That's right. That's exactly right. So it's an alliance between the creditors and the looters, who are for the most part their customers.
So does this echo the kind of thing that John Perkins talked about in his book, The Confessions of an Economic Hitman? He describes this system where you have these massive loans made for, I don't know, infrastructure projects of various kinds with all sorts of promises attached to it. And then, you know, that money's paid to corporations, perhaps US-based corporations, to do the work. And so you get these highways being built, power plants being built, and there are these reckless promises about, oh, the GDP is going to pay everything off. And then, of course, the debt can't be dealt with. And so then the IMF steps in to help by imposing the very kinds of things you just talked about, taxes and privatization, asset stripping, perhaps we might call it.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. They're just now taking the IMF conditionality agreements, widely used in Latin America, and they're now applying it to Europe, in fact, to their own members. I mean, the EU is now doing this to itself. So it shows how desperate. Apparently, there's no money to be made except through looting. So now the EU is starting to loot itself. It's looting Greece and, of course, Italy, Spain, Portugal are waiting. I think Ireland's already been looted. They tried to loot Iceland, but tiny Iceland fought them off.
Yes, good for them. I mean, John Perkins describes it as a corporatocracy, a global corporatocracy in being built. So, I mean, you say that it's the EU doing it, but, I mean, would you say that it's the EU as just a kind of arm of this corporatocracy?
I said the EU's doing it to Greece. They're doing it to their own compatriots. See, when the Americans were doing it, it was to foreign countries in Latin America, Indonesia. But now you see the EU's eating itself. They're now eating up Greece. Then they'll turn and eat up Italy and Spain. So that's one principle. Now, the other principle is to further centralize political power in Brussels. as opposed to the member states, because the consequence of the agreements Greece has been forced into is that they no longer have control over their own fiscal policy. The taxing and spend decisions are no longer decided by the Greeks. They're imposed from outside. And when this crisis started 4 or 5 years ago, the current head of the European Central Bank at that time, Trichet, said explicitly that the crisis would be used in order to further centralize power in Brussels and to move beyond the notion of a national state, to move Europe beyond the notion of a national state. So they can do this to all EU members that don't have their own money. And I think Britain and one or two other countries have their own money, but all the other members don't. And so they're vulnerable to ceasing to be sovereign countries. So those are the two real reasons, and it's why the Germans and the EU were so inflexible toward the Greeks, because they're not concerned about the debt. It's easy to deal with the debt. The debt is a weapon. It's a cloak for the real agendas. And the real agendas are those to establish those two principles.
Well, I noticed that you mentioned Trichet in an article or something. And so I came across his, I think it was his retiring speech. It's from 2011, Today and the Day After Tomorrow, looking at the future as he sees it for the EU. And he says things along the lines of what you've just said there. So let me just quote from him. Quote, first and foremost, every country in the euro area needs to keep its own house in order. This means responsible economic policies on behalf of governments and rigorous mutual surveillance of those policies by the Commission and member states, going beyond the indispensable surveillance of fiscal policies to encompass all aspects of the economy. And then he goes on to talk about a new concept of sovereignty, which seems to me from reading it like no sovereignty at all, really.
Well, I actually quote him in my book, The Failure of Laissez-Faire Capitalism. And he says that the realities are that joining the EU meant that you were no longer actually sovereign, that you did not have complete internal authority because your affairs had to be conducted in a way that was consistent with the EU and consistent with the fact that the EU Central Bank would not support your debt. He says on June 2nd, 2011, that the task is to bring Europe beyond a strict concept of nationhood and the traditional practice of protecting debtors. Whether a country can afford to pay its debts is no longer a question of its budgetary condition if the country has public domain that can be privatized. So it's used, you see, to get rid of any vestige of public ownership. It's used for privatization, which is the movement of national assets into the hands of the 1%. That's why the debt crisis isn't resolved, because it could be easily resolved, as we've already discussed.
And of course, a decimation of the very notion of democracy, because nobody within those countries can act in any way to make any difference to this, because it's just a kind of technocratic decision from the top.
Exactly. The countries that joined the EU essentially joined an incipient fascist state. And they won't be able to get out because the United States won't allow it.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that in a minute. But I mean, I think the thing that needs to be cleared up in my mind anyway is, I don't know whether you have an answer to this, but you know, why did Tsipras actually cave in to these demands? I mean, given that he did have this mandate from the Greek people to stand up against this, why do you think he actually said in the end, okay, well, let's go for it?
Because the Greeks did not have a backup plan. The Greek government assumed, especially after it had the backing of the referendum. You see, prior to that referendum, the Greek government was sort of in a minority position. It had gotten 36-37% of the vote in the election. And this did not make it very credible to the powerful forces it was negotiating with. But the referendum then indicated that this was no longer a minority government, that it had the support of a majority of the country. And so with that support, what the Greek government thought was that their economic arguments and their facts and their evidence. They had already had two rounds of austerity. This was the third round coming. So they had arguments and facts showing that what the austerity had done was to worsen the debt situation by driving down the economy so that the percentage of GDP comprised by the debt had gone way up. You know, the economy has dropped 27%. That's like a depression. So they thought that the EU had some goodwill toward its own member states and that evidence would count. And so they had no backup plan. And when they found out that there was no goodwill toward them whatsoever, he said, I don't think the Greek government ever understood that the EU did not see this as a debt issue. It saw it exactly as I described. I don't think they understood that. And so when they went, they had no backup plan. Well, you can't just leave a monetary system when you don't have one, when you don't know how to put one back in place, when your banks are closed. In other words, it was an impossible situation for the Greek government. Yeah. People say, oh, he sold out. He betrayed the people. He literally had no choice. So where the Greek government went wrong was trusting the EU to have goodwill toward Greece. Right.
Yeah, I get that impression from looking at the blog of Yanis Varoufakis, because he says that prior to this, you know, they were the prime minister's headquarters and they were saying things like, you know, we're going to bring home a financially viable agreement. We're going to compromise, but we won't be compromised, he writes. We'll step back just as much as is needed to secure an agreement with the Eurozone. So there was that sort of positivity that now they had this, as you say, this mandate.
Well, they were very gullible and naive. They were very naive. They didn't understand what the whole issue was about. And they kept trying to work out how we can pay the debt. Well, that's not of any concern whatsoever to the EU. The EU doesn't want the debt paid. The worse trouble they get in, the more power the EU has over them. So the solution is what the EU wants, is to establish those two principles, that creditors are not responsible for their own bad loans, and the member states of the EU no longer have sovereignty over their internal fiscal policies. And that is the consequence, and that's what Europe wants out of this. They don't want to resolve debt problem.
Well, I must admit, Varoufakis's tone now is very strident, but he's talking about this being a kind of blackmail situation, really. You know, you go along with what we say, or we're going to shut down your banks and cause absolute chaos, and he calls it a putschist and unimaginable aggression.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what it is. And I laid all this out in this book, The Failure of Laissez-Faire Capitalism. I described exactly what the issue was, exactly how it would happen. I'm 100% right. They could have read the book before they went negotiating, but no one bothered. So what do you do now?
Well, that's it. I mean, is it actually too late, do you think, for Greece to leave the Eurozone? Could they just change their mind?
Well, just as the first round of austerity made it worse, and the second round made it further worse, the third round will make it worse. So it's not a solution. You see, this money doesn't go to Greece. It goes to creditors, or not even to the creditors, because I think a lot of the debt is no longer held by the creditors. For example, New York hedge funds bought up a lot of the debt when it was selling at discounted rates because of the fear it wouldn't be paid. They bought it as a speculation, expecting that it would all work out and they would get 100 cents on the dollar. The European Central Bank actually has some of the debt that it bought from the banks. You know, the European Central Bank prints 60 billion euros a month. It's quantitative easing. They're using it to buy up troubled assets. So the creditors are not really the issue. The issues are what I said they are.
Well, can I put something to you? This comes again from Yanis Varoufakis' blog, and this is to do with, you know, what is the reason for this. And one of the things he puts forward on the blog is what he calls Wolfgang Schäuble's plan. And he says that this actually comes from Schäuble himself, that he's been told this. He says that Schäuble wants Greece to default on its debts, leave the Eurozone, because that would show that bailing out doesn't work. And the only thing that therefore does work is full federal union. So Greece would then be a kind of scapegoat, a sacrifice, so that it could really clamp down on centralizing fiscal control. Do you think there's a possibility that that might happen?
Well, this could well be in the minds of the Germans, but the United States would not stand for it. So to come back to your previous question, we'll marry these two questions. Is it too late for Greece to leave? The only way Greece could leave would be to have its own currency. Well, how is it going to have its own currency when it has no reserves to protect it? If the Greeks just say, okay, we're out, we've got the drachma, speculators, the hedge funds, the European Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, they'll jump all over the currency and drive it down to zero. It'll be retribution, you see.
So could they look to Russia for support?
They would have to do something like that. Russia, China, the BRICS. But look now what this means. Here is the unraveling of the EU. It's the unraveling of NATO. What is important to Washington is NATO. It's the mechanism Washington uses to bring conflict to Russia. So they're not going to allow Greece to leave the EU. In fact, you may remember right during the crisis, Obama made statements that the EU should modify its demands on Greece and be more accommodating. You may remember that the American Secretary of the Treasury, Jack Lew, went to meet with the Germans and the EU, and he told them, under no conditions will the United States accept Greece being driven out of the EU. Just forget it. It's not going to happen. So what the EU told Jack Lew, they said, look, Greece has a backup plan, so we don't have to give them concessions because they don't have an alternative. They have to stay. And so we don't need to give them concessions that Obama's calling for because we're not going to lose them. They haven't any way to leave. So it's true now that the Greeks have time. They could devise some plan if they could get the Russians, the Chinese to take the risk of angering Washington to that extent. But what would happen in that case? One of two things. Either the Greek government would be assassinated, or Washington would call up the EU Central Bank and say, you don't have any say about this. Print the euros right now and buy up the Greek debt, or else. So Greece will probably, in the end, get the concessions, because without them, its situation is impossible, and it would have to leave. But Washington is not going to allow it to leave, and therefore Washington will impose concessions on the idiot Germans and on the European Commission.
Okay, and I suppose that could be presented via the media in such a way as to say, look how costly this whole situation is. That shows that we need to clamp down on the whole EU and have complete fiscal control as an EU federal union. I suppose it could be done that way, couldn't it? The same Schäuble plan could...
Exactly, Julian. The same thing that would resolve the Greek situation would then be used with Spain, Italy, Portugal. And, of course, the French are indebted. So you would end up where essentially every member of the EU, I don't know how the Germans would escape.
So a creeping privatization of the whole EU.
That's right. And the loss of any sovereignty of the member governments. It wouldn't be a Greek government anymore. There would be like a governor, say, the governor of New York or the governor of Montana or Georgia or Alabama or Virginia. The countries would become provinces of the EU, and what are national governments would be like administrative vehicles for the EU. And that's where it's headed. That's what they're trying to achieve. That's what they're using the Greek sovereign debt crisis for. And I suspect that's what will happen, because Washington is not going to risk NATO unraveling by Greece's departure. Because if Greece goes out and comes out of this, the Italians are going to say, why are we in it? Why are we staying? And the Spanish and the Portuguese. And so the thing spreads, and then you find out that all of Southern Europe is now part of the Russian Eurasian economic. And Washington will not accept it. Will simply not accept it. And if Washington gives an order to Germany and to the EU, they're going to obey it. They don't have any choice whatsoever.
And I suppose if Russia did actually succeed in giving some support to any of these countries, that would be seen as an act of aggression in its own right.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think it'd be risky for the Russians. And it may be the reason they haven't acted. You know, it's actually in the interest of Russia and China to go to these countries and say, look, we'll pay you to leave. We'll support you because it's cheaper than the military buildup that the Americans are forcing on us. It's cheaper for us to pay your bills. How much do you need? Just tell us and you leave. But you see, if they were to do that, Washington would probably be some preemptive nuclear attack. You see, it would be a direct threat to the empire in the way that we have threatened Russia by trying to take over Ukraine. Mm. Just as Russia can't accept Ukraine being a NATO member, the United States can't accept the Greeks or any part of Europe being in the Russian bloc. Yeah. So
I can read the headlines already. Putin is resurrecting the Soviet Union in a military sense now.
Yeah, right. It's probably too risky. I mean, Putin is he likes to be non-provocative, and this would be a very provocative thing. Mm.
In one of your pieces, one of your latest pieces, you say that this whole Greek drama is instructive, actually, for Russia and Iran in that it shows that they basically can't trust the West. Could you flesh that out a bit more for us?
Well, you see, the Greeks found out that there's no goodwill toward them. They are part of the EU. They're part of the West. They're the birthplace of democracy. They're all of this, you know. And what have the Greeks found out? There's absolutely no goodwill whatsoever against them. And they are being looted by their compatriots. So then how can Russia expect any goodwill or Iran expect any goodwill? They can't. And there's not any goodwill toward them. So what does this mean? Well, it means Putin's diplomacy is a dead end. It can't go anywhere because without goodwill, there can't be diplomacy. And yet Putin has bet everything on diplomacy. He's accepted provocation after provocation. He's accepted deteriorating conditions from his standpoint in Ukraine. The Americans are there now. They're training troops. They're supplying troops. The breakaway republics have been complying with the Minsk agreement, but the Ukrainian government hasn't. So the whole military position is weaker from the Russian standpoint than it was. The crisis is continuing. I mean, the Russians could have ended this crisis early on simply by reabsorbing the two breakaway republics, who did the same thing the Crimeans did. They voted to rejoin Russia, and Putin turned them down. He thought it was too provocative. He was going to rely on diplomacy. Well, all of these things are going to come back to haunt Russia because there's no sign that Washington is telling the Ukrainians to comply with the agreement. There's every sign Washington intends the agreement not be complied with. So that means diplomacy will not work for the Russians. It's not going to work for the Iranians. The Iranians may think, oh, now we can be part of the West again. The United States can put sanctions back on them anytime it wants to. All it has to do is make some charge. You know, the attack on Iran never had anything whatsoever to do with a nuclear weapons program. This was a cover, just like the Greek debt is a cover for the real agenda. In Iran, the nuclear weapons is a cover for the real agenda, which is the United States simply does not accept countries with independent foreign policies.
My understanding is that there is actually no evidence to suggest that Iran is producing, you know, this enriched uranium for weaponized purposes.
Well, look, the National Intelligence Report, which came out in the United States 3 or 4 years ago, signed off by all 16 intelligence agencies, said that Iran had had no interest in a nuclear weapon for at least a decade, and that all efforts in that direction had stopped 10 years ago. The inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency are on the ground in Iran. They have always reported that they find no diversion of enriched uranium from the nuclear energy program. Under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, of which Iran is a signatory, they have the right to nuclear energy. And yet, by insisting on its treaty rights, Washington has been able to demonize them for doing what's perfectly legal. And this was a cover. And what all of this pressure and sanctions was, the purpose of it is to force Iran to go along with Washington and Washington's policies, which Iran wouldn't do. indeed, they can't really do it. I mean, it's supposed to be a revolutionary government. Remember, we overthrew the democratic government. We stuck in the Shah. We ruled them through this puppet for a number of years. Then they had this revolution, and they're back. And we're trying to say, well, look, you got to do what we say, whether or not the Shah is there or not. And they're not willing to do that. But that's what the real issue is. The nuclear weapon thing, it was no more real than Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction or Assad's use of chemical weapons or whatever the lies they were telling about Gaddafi. All of these is cover for getting rid of regimes that had independent policies.
Yeah. So would you say then that this nuclear deal has actually brought Iran into Washington's orbit in a significant way?
Well, I don't know. I don't know how aware they are. I mean, what's so stunning is how even Washington's victims, even its targets, end up accepting Washington's definition of the problem. So what does Iran think the problem has been? Well, it's been this suspicion that they're going to make a weapon. And they probably think that's what the problem was. Oh, the Americans, for some reason, don't believe us. They think we're making a weapon. They insist we have to give up our nuclear energy program so that we can't divert to make a weapon. But we're not making a weapon. We just have to convince them. And we have to keep negotiating. We'll work out an agreement. Something, one day they'll see we're not actually making a weapon. That was probably in the Iranians' head the whole time. They probably never said, they know good and well we're not making a weapon. This has nothing to do with weapons. This is doing with knuckling us under. If they don't know that, then, yeah, they're now more vulnerable than ever. And I saw just the other day where some alleged expert in the Council of Foreign Relations was giving advice to Iran. Now that this $100 billion of their money that we stole and froze has to be returned, the expert is saying, oh, be sure you invest that in the United States and Europe.
But if they do that, then that could just be frozen again, couldn't it?
Exactly.
At will.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, of course, if Iran doesn't comply in some significant way with some important U.S. policy, then charges will come back. There may be new charges. They may blame Iran for terrorism. There may be a false flag attack, or they may claim that they're making weapons, or they may get the International Atomic Energy Agency to say, oh, there may have been some diversion. See, they've pressured the International Atomic Energy Agency on a number of occasions. I say they, Washington has pressured this agency on a number of occasions to give less than perfectly clear reports, so that they would have some doubt expressed that Washington could exploit against Iran. You know, once or twice, they just about got that. And they can get it. They can put enough pressure. So, yeah, you could end up having a report where they say, well, we don't really know. They might have diverted some. And then that's all Washington needs. So it's far from over. Iran is either going to have to capitulate and conform to Washington's policies in that region, or the pressure will continue. Or else the neoconservatives who control American foreign and military policies have to lose influence and be moved aside. One of those three things is going to happen. Iran surrenders, or the neocons lose their influence, or this thing is far from over.
And if this thing is far from over, do you think there's any possibility to the suggestion that, I believe it was Tony Cartellucci reading a Brookings Institution report called Which Path to Persia? There was a clause in there, a suggestion as to how this kind of thing might play out, and that was to say, well, the US could show lenience and diplomacy, and then Israel could be very upset about this and then take some kind of unilateral action, which of course would all be within the purview of Washington actually, but that would be a hidden matter, and therefore Washington would have plausible deniability.
Yeah, that's a possibility. I don't know that Washington would use that other than a threat with Iran, because I don't think Washington really wants anybody acting independently of Washington or showing independent action. It might encourage the others. So if they let the Israelis do it, then other countries might think they can act independently. Mm. So I think it would be something that Washington would tell the Iranians, oh my gosh, look, you better hurry up and get in line because the Israelis are going to attack you.
Right,
they won't
right.
listen to us and blah, blah. I mean, I can see that happening. But I don't think that Washington wants Israel to take any initiative away from Washington because Washington is the unipolar, not Israel. And therefore, to have some dependency acting without your authority, it undermines your
sure,
image.
Sure. And you say that in this piece that you say that actually they want to take the focus off Iran so that they can put their resources most fully on what they are saying is the greatest threat, which is Russia and China.
Right. Yeah. They have to do that now. You see, we've probably talked about the Wolfowitz Doctrine before, haven't we, Julian?
Yeah, we did. Mm-hmm.
And it says that the primary goal of American foreign policy is to prevent the rise of any other country that could serve as a constraint on Washington's hegemony. Clearly, that's Russia and China, not Iran. And so if they've got Iran surrounded, I think they had at one time 42 military bases around Iran. They had several fleets in the Persian Gulf. That's a huge commitment to Iran when you've got the Islamic State running wild, yeah. China coming on strong, you've got Putin's Russia rising. You know, the neocons were distracted for a decade in the Middle East with all of their wars that didn't work out right. And they weren't paying any attention. They thought it would take China 50 years. And they thought that Putin would continue the subservience of Yeltsin. But when Putin said, no, you don't attack Syria. No, you don't bomb Iran. Then they realized, hey, my goodness, here's a real constraint. We've got to do something about it. And that's when they started in on the Ukraine. And so now, if you look, all of the attention, it's shifted entirely from the Islamic State. It's Russia's going to invade Baltics. Russia's going to invade Poland. Russia has invaded Ukraine.
Do you think they could, you know, Washington, in a sense, could leave Islamic State now to Iran?
Yeah, it could well be that Washington just says, okay, this is Iran's problem now. It's a better use of our time and energy to leave that for Iran. And furthermore, how are we going to pivot to Asia and have 60% of our fleet bottling up the Chinese if we got to have three fleets in the Persian Gulf? So the whole thing is to free up the resources, to free up the time, the energy, the news focus, and to put it on Russia. You may have seen we've now organized for the Dutch are one of them, the Poland, I think it is. The Dutch and the Polish are now going to create a propaganda agency that translates Washington's propaganda into Russian and beams it into Russia and into the Russian-speaking populations in Eastern Europe. You know, there are a lot of Russians there because it was a long time part of the Soviet Union.
Right.
So we're starting to ratchet up the propaganda war against Russia. We've got the Swedes convinced that they're going to be attacked. The Finns are convinced they're going to be attacked by Russia. The whole thing is ratcheting up, and you can see the focus is now on demonizing Russia.
Mm. Do you think that Iran also plays into it in the sense that you can then cut off Europe from gas and oil supplies from Russia and shift that to Iran so you can isolate Russia in that sense as well?
Yeah, I think that's also a hope in Washington. You see, Washington has never been happy with Europe's dependence on Russian energy.
Mm.
That's why they oppose that Russian pipeline that would come into Bulgaria. You know, they block that. That's why the Russians announced it's going to go under the Black Sea to Turkey, to the Greek border, which is another reason Washington won't let the Greeks out of the EU. So if they can figure out how to get a pipeline from Iran to Europe, then this is really good for Washington because they can get an alternative source of energy into Europe that removes the threat that the economic relations with Russia will be too strong on Europe and that Europe will gradually move away from American positions because of its energy dependence.
Would this be a good time now to ask you for your reaction to David Cameron? You say that you haven't actually heard what he said the other day. May I let you know what he said?
Sure.
Well, he was giving this speech in Birmingham, UK, of course, about extremism and non-violent extremism and this kind of idea that, you know, there are various modes of thought that encourage somehow or other extremism and terrorism. And rather like he did at the UN last year, he also pointed the finger at people who question things like 9/11 and 7/7. And one of the things he said, for example, was, let me quote this. He said, the security services aren't behind terrorist attacks. And of course, there he was negating the idea that some people might say the security services are indeed behind terrorist attacks, you see. So he was therefore still echoing this kind of thought. And Glenn Greenwald tweeted at the time when he was saying this, I'm going to quote him actually, he says, David Cameron is right at this moment delivering one of the creepiest and most authoritarian speeches you'll ever hear. And I have to say, when I saw the video of what David Cameron was saying, I really did think it was extremely creepy, because I am obviously somebody, as indeed you are, Dr. Roberts, who questions 9/11, and I am therefore being called a non-violent extremist. I'm not exactly sure what that's supposed to mean, but it's quite frightening language. And because what I immediately think of is the way that the term conspiracy theorist was weaponized, as James Tracy says, but back in the 1960s, you know, with respect to doubting the official version of the JFK assassination, and it has functioned very effectively ever since as a kind of thought stopper. Here, it seems to be ratcheted up so that it's not just that you might be accused of being crazy for being an inverted commas conspiracy theorist, but now you are bad. Now you are evil for thinking that the government might have done something wrong behind the scenes. That's how I react to it, and I think it could be a shutting down of people's thoughts and a shutting down of people's free speech. Although, amazingly, David Cameron in the same speech said he actually believes in freedom of speech. So could I have your reaction to our beloved Prime Minister David Cameron?
Well, it's the same thing is said here. I mean, it began here with the former head of the Homeland Security, who's now the chancellor of the University of California. She was the first one who said that the focus of Homeland Security had moved from a Muslim terrorist to domestic extremist. And in the ranks of domestic extremists were war protesters, environmental activists, animal rights activists, and in general, doubters of the government's national security positions. So this is just Washington having its puppet. David Cameron is nothing but a puppet. Bring this same development into England, and it will go on into the EU, into Germany, and everywhere else. Now, it's a known fact that security forces do commit terrorist operations. We know, for example, of Operation Gladio.
Absolutely.
And this was an operation of Italian and other Western intelligence services together with the CIA to blow up with bombs European women and children in order to blame local communist parties to undermine their electoral support. The president of Italy announced this. The parliament made extensive investigations. The intelligence services confessed. We also know of the Northwoods Project. The Northwoods Project was brought to President Kennedy by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It called for U.S. military to shoot down American airliners, to shoot down American citizens on the streets of Washington and Miami, to strafe refugee boats coming from Cuba, and to blame Castro so that we could invade and have regime change in Cuba. All of this is public now. It was released by the second John Kennedy investigation. It was released by Congress. You can go online and pull it up. There are the documents with the seal of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, marked top secret, signed by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. It's all public. This is not a conspiracy theory. It's just known facts. So they do commit it. For Cameron to stand up and say they don't, I mean, why should he lie through his teeth before the world? Everybody knows they do these things. I learned in my Russian studies years ago, I learned that the Tsarist secret police set off bombs so they could arrest labor agitators. So what does it mean? It means that the entire Western agenda is based on lies. and therefore is vulnerable. And therefore, people must not be able to expose the lies. And if they do expose the lies, then the whole agenda comes down, if anybody believes them. And so we've got to shut it up. And that's what it means. That's what Cameron is doing. That's what the head of the Homeland Security here is doing. It's to protect a system based on nothing but lies and false flag attacks. All of these wars are based on 9/11.
And yet they seem to cloak this behind this dreadful phrase, British values, that keeps on coming up. So if anybody questions the government, then they are going against British values. And it's really instructive. And I shall link to this in the show notes. There's an interview of Theresa May, the Home Secretary here. This is back in May. And John Humphreys of BBC Radio 4 was interviewing her. And he was asking her, you know, what does extremism mean? You know, what is a non-violent extremist? And she didn't answer. She just went on and on back to this, it's against British values. And he was saying, well, where's the line? You know, what is a British value? And then where do you cross the line of actually going against the value? And she just couldn't answer.
You see, what is a British value? Well, Tony Blair made it clear. It's lying to the British people. It's lying to the world. It's participating in America's attack on totally innocent people, killing upwards to 1 million of them, displacing another 4 million and leaving countless numbers maimed, orphaned. This is what a British value is. And so we can't have anybody point that out.
A lot of people have said, you know, when you listen to David Cameron making that kind of speech, that sounds like a really extremist speech in itself. It is incredibly Orwellian and topsy-turvy.
You know what he sounds like? That guy in the movie, V for Vendetta, the British dictator.
Right.
That's who Cameron reminds me of. He reminds me of the British dictator in the movie V for Vendetta.
May I share with you this wonderful quote here I have from him? This apparently is, what David Cameron apparently will say to the National Security Council with respect to the counter-extremism bill. And I'll link to it. It's an official page. The Prime Minister will say to the NSC, quote, "For too long, we have been a passively tolerant society, saying to our citizens, as long as you obey the law, we will leave you alone."
Well, this whole notion of preemptive arrest comes from Jeremy Bentham, an 18th century Englishman. Of course, it was totally contrary to traditional English law, to Blackstone, whom Bentham hated. And so this notion of preempting something that might happen in the future. See, Bentham wanted to arrest the criminals in advance of crime. And the question was, well, who are the criminals? How do you know who they are? And, well, they were the poor people, or they were, you see what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But it didn't matter who they were. But if you got the wrong ones, at least you got some of the right ones. Mm. And so the notion that preemptive arrest is a way to prevent things from happening in the future. We now have this with regard to nuclear war because the George W. Bush regime, in probably what is the most horrendous of all of these episodes, redefined the purpose of nuclear weapons from retaliation against an attack. Therefore, they serve as a deterrent to use. He redefined nuclear weapons in American war doctrine as preemptive first strike, so that we now have nuclear weapons justified for Washington to use, not to deter attack, but to initiate an attack in a preemptive way. So this is kind of the threat that hangs over Russia and China, that they may receive a preemptive attack.
Well, may I come full circle? And obviously the majority of our conversation has been about Greece and the situation that it's in, the desperate and seemingly inextricable situation that it's in. And I suppose what I want to ask you to end with really is, do you think, practically speaking, that Greece is really just shut up in this situation and is in this condition of serfdom, as indeed Varoufakis describes it? Or do you think there is some real possibility that they can do something? You know, I'm not looking at that solution of involving Russia and all the difficulties that would involve. Is there something else that they can do? Or do you think they are shackled now?
Well, I think they're shackled. You see, what will happen is the youth will immigrate, because if you're part of the EU, you can leave Greece, right? They can go to Britain, they can go to France, they can leave. So the youth will leave. So the country will die. There'll be old people there, and their pensions have been cut. I saw the other day that now the disability pension in Greece has been reduced to $94 a month.
Right.
All right. So, yeah. And what will happen? In will come all of the refugees from Britain and America's wars in the Middle East and Africa. And all of these refugees will pour into Greece because there won't be any Greeks there, except the old people dying on $94 a month. So that's Greece's future. Now, it's entirely possible that this will produce such enormous hardship that it can't be tolerated, and that the Greeks have no alternative but to leave. At that point, the Americans will not permit them leaving, and the Americans will order the EU to alleviate the conditions in Greece. And if the EU doesn't obey, the Americans will destroy the EU, because they are a puppet and they have to follow their orders, and they will follow their orders. So that is the best the Greeks can hope.
And so if that plays out, then this whole process, you know, the kind of Perkins process of privatization, which will creep across the whole of the EU, then we'll have the kind of thing that Varoufakis actually describes when he looks at the agreement, so-called agreement that's been reached, and he sort of removes the Orwellian language and the terminology, and he puts in red print what he thinks it actually means, and he lists all these foreclosures and liquidation and downward spiraling national debt, asset stripping, and no unions, no collective bargaining for pay or conditions, pensions destroyed, welfare destroyed. So that scenario there, which he describes, would play out across the whole of the EU, like a sort of growing gangrenous fasciitis.
Well, that was obvious from the beginning, and a lot of people pointed that out, that if you join the EU, you were giving up your sovereignty. It's just like Trichet said. He says that EU interdependence, quote, means that countries de facto do not have complete internal authority. The Greek thing is leading to what he calls the second stage, which would make this de facto loss of sovereignty de jure.
Right.
So what is a de facto gift of your sovereignty becomes enshrined in law. And so this leads to a second stage of central intervention, which would now come into play. European Union authorities would exercise an authoritative say in the formation of the country's economic policies.
So, of course, I think what was not foreseen, certainly by people like me, who I've always opposed the idea of a federal EU, because I took a leaf out of Karl Popper's essay Utopian Violence, where he says that if you try to impress a blueprint upon people without their agreement, then you're going to end up with violence. So I've always thought, you know, the EU can't work, but I've never, you know, as a federal union, but I've never thought of it in terms of this particular mechanism of asset stripping and putting people into bondage in order to achieve this. So in some respects, then perhaps it would be better not to allow this process to continue, but just to say, okay, well, we'll give up now and just allow this centralization and control of fiscal realities right across the union to be in place now. So this would be the Schäuble plan being successful. Apart from, the only other alternative, I presume, would be to just say, well, the US needs to collapse.
The US, yeah. But you see, the dollar's the world reserve currency and everybody holds it. So that's the basis. It's not clear how the U.S. is going to collapse in that circumstance. The EU, it should collapse, but I don't think there's any possibility of that happening either. And the reason for the asset stripping is that it's a way the 1% can make more money as this process goes forward. Now, of course, it can go forward without them. If the various member governments look at the situation and see, well, there's no way out of this, so let's just get over the debt issue by giving up our sovereignty. So that could happen. It really depends on how much fire and spirit and independence is left in European peoples. There may be some, there may not be. I mean, the Greeks do get into the streets, but whether or not they're prepared for a revolution, I don't know. Where does the Greek military stand? I mean, who controls it? The U.S. or the Greek government. I mean, it's not clear where the Greek military stands. I mean, so I don't think that we're going to see anything favorable to democracy and freedom come out of the EU. You're going to see the authoritarian, merciless state that George Orwell describes in 1984, and that's what the EU is.
Indeed, it's becoming increasingly obvious that that is the case. And, well, it seems horrible in a way to end on a negative note, but I suppose we are talking about realities here, and we have to accept the reality as it faces us. But I suppose in a way that's a good thing. If we can actually realise the dire situation that's there, then that is a spur for us to, as you say, do something about it, in the sense of asking what can we actually do, instead of just succumbing to the media, which tells us that we have to do as we're told all the time.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, Judith, let me give an optimistic note. I suppose it is possible that Europeans, not just the people, but the puppet governments, it's possible that they could realize that the United States is pushing them into conflict with Russia that means nuclear war, in which case they have no interest. This becomes a price too high. And if the European governments were able to realize that, then they may break off from the United States and have an independent foreign policy and try to move away from this confrontation. But if they don't realize that, the Orwellian state will disappear with all the others, because nuclear war has no survivors. It has no victors. The Americans are pushing toward nuclear war because the Americans will not give up their demand that they are the world, the people who exercise world hegemony over others. And that is what's driving all of this. It's this American neoconservative ideology. All of the Europeans can see that they are what enables this, and that NATO doesn't need to be there. It should have gone away when the Soviet Union collapsed. If they can realize that, break from Washington, then the whole world can be different.
And I think I asked you before in a previous interview if you think that the predictions that are being made by many people, that there may be a financial collapse even this year, towards the end of this year, that this might actually precipitate a very different situation and mean that Washington can't wield the kind of influence that it does at the moment.
Well, I've often thought that, but the more that I see the ability of Washington to rig the financial markets, you know, Washington can print all the money it wants. And if you print money and buy up stocks, they can't fall. If you print money and buy up bonds, they can't fall. So I don't really know. Well, I think what Washington has learned is that it can rig financial markets to such an extent, one way or the other. I mean, right now you would think that gold price would be through the roof, and yet it keeps falling because Washington drives it down by selling naked shorts in the futures market. And no one catches on. It's not stopped. It's illegal, of course. So I don't know. I used to think that financial crisis would undo the dollar, and with it, Washington's power. But now I'm beginning to wonder, how could this? Maybe in the distant future. I mean, maybe if the BRICS become highly successful, maybe they start drawing away the talent from the West because it's the only place there's any economic development or action to. The money becomes stronger and stronger, and the gold reserves of China build and build. And it's possible then that Europe just, and the United States and Canada and Australia just become backwaters, in which case they become relatively unimportant. I mean, that's always possible, but that's time into the future.
And in the meantime, there's always this threat of nuclear war hanging over
us.
That's
right. That's
right.
Yeah. What kind of miscalculation? And you see, I dramatize this. There have been all these reports of how close we've come in the past to accidental war. And usually it's because somebody low down uses their judgment and doesn't send on the warning. And that's usually what saves us. But now think about today. Think about some American officer somewhere in a strategic command, and he's subject to constant demonizations of, you know, Russia is this, Putin's rebuilding the empire, the Russians are invading Ukraine, the Russians are going to invade Poland, the Baltics, this, this. He just gets this over and over and over and over, and he's sitting there, and in comes a false signal of Russian missiles. What's he going to do? He's already loaded up. He's already primed to expect that. The propaganda has produced in his head the reality. He doesn't say, oh, this must be a bad report. There's no reason for them to be sending missiles over here. And so that's how you get these wars. You can get that unintentionally. It's very easy when you get everybody so full of propaganda. And
so he would function like a kind of doomsday machine then, really.
That's right.
Propagandized into have a robot mentality. And so it would be a kind of Dr. Strangelove situation would play out.
You've got it. That's it. Well, I think we've exhausted the subjects.
I think we have, Dr. Roberts. It's been, as always, great speaking with you. Always sobering, of course, but then that's a good thing because we need to be sober about these very difficult realities that are there and stretch before us. So it has been wonderful speaking to you. Thank you very much indeed for coming on the show again, and I very much look forward to speaking to you again.
Okay, Julian, I look forward to it too. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. You're so well-informed and perceptive, and I very much appreciate your commitment to truth.
Thank you, and I yours. Thank you. Well, thank you for listening. Please do visit us at the website themindrenewed.com, where you will find over 100 programs, interviews, and episodes on a wide variety of subjects of interest and concern from over the last couple of years, very many of which continue to be relevant to the current time. And if you go to the Topics tab, you'll find the programs organized in convenient categories for easy access to the things that you might be interested in. And if you found this program or any other that you listen to on The Mind Renewed interesting and useful, and you think that others might be interested in hearing it too, please do share it via social media or even good old-fashioned word of mouth. And if you use iTunes, please do consider leaving a comment and rating, for which I would be very grateful. So finally, thanks for joining us today. You have been listening to me, Julian Charles, of themindrenewed.com, and I look forward to speaking to you again in the very near future.